You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The World of the Senses and the World of the Spirit, Lecture 2, given in Hanover on the 28th of December, 1911. In our considerations yesterday, we reached the state of soul which we described as acquiescence. We saw that it is as yet the highest of the soul states to be attained if thinking, what we ordinarily describe as knowledge, is to enter into reality. If thinking is to have any connection with genuine reality, thinking, in other words, that has raised itself through the states of soul, firstly of amazement, then of reverence toward the world of reality, and then what we termed a wisdom-filled harmony with the world's phenomena. A thinking incapable of raising itself, in addition, into the soul region characterized as acquiescence, would not be capable of reaching reality. This acquiescence can only be attained by means of endeavoring energetically to become ever and again aware of the incompetence of mere thinking, and by means also of endeavoring to create a lively and energetic mood which continuously says to us, you should not expect your thinking to provide you with knowledge of what is true, to give you knowledge of the truth. You should initially only expect your thinking to educate you, to bring you up. It is exceedingly important to develop within us this mood of sensing that our thinking educates us. You see, if you really carry this principle through in a practical way, you will be able to reach beyond a good deal more than you would normally expect. I suspect that not very many of you have made a thorough study of the philosopher Kant, but this would not have been necessary anyway. All that needs to be said at present is that in Kant's most important, most pioneering work, titled Critique of Pure Reason, there was always a for and an against for every proof. For example, let us take the sentence stating that the world had its beginning in time. To this, he might add, on the next page, the statement that the world has existed forever, in all eternity. Kant puts forward valid arguments in favor of each of these statements, even though they are obviously contradictory. In other words, he proves that the world had a beginning and that the world did not have a beginning. Kant describes these statements as an antinomy, which he is using in order to demonstrate the limitations of the human capacity for knowledge. He wants to show that human beings must of necessity arrive at such contradictory argumentations. The fact is that as long as we are of the opinion that we can reach the truth by means of thinking, by means of working with concepts, by means of, let's say, thinking about experiences, in other words, as long as we hope to arrive at a consensus of objective realities, as long as this is our belief, it will be very dreadful for us if we are shown that each of two opposites can be proven to be true. How can such proofs lead us to reality? However, if we have trained ourselves to realize that at the very point where decisiveness should be crucial, thinking can have nothing to say about reality, if we have energetically trained ourselves to regard thinking merely as a means toward achieving wisdom, as a means to be taken in hand for the purpose of educating ourselves toward wisdom, then we shall not be disturbed by finding that first one thing and then its opposite can be proven. Once we have reached this point, we will soon notice that with regard to working on concepts, reality can have no effect on us, and thus we can work among the concepts and ideas in utter freedom, and in this way educate ourselves. If we were to be constantly corrected by reality, then working on the concepts would not be a means toward educating ourselves in freedom. Take good account of the fact that working on our concepts only presents us with an effective and free means of educating ourselves, if we do not permit reality to interfere with our work. What do we mean by saying it will not interfere with our work? How would reality interfere in our free work on the concepts? We can, to some extent, imagine such interference if we hypothetically confront our human thinking with divine thinking. And we shall see later that this need not remain hypothetical. We can say to ourselves, in the first instance, we cannot conceive of divine thinking having nothing to do with reality. We can only conceive that divine thinking, hypothetically at first, most certainly does have something to do with reality. This indicates something most important, namely that if a human being makes a mistake in his thinking, it is merely a mistake, but nothing too dreadful. And if he subsequently realizes that he has made a mistake, he can correct it, thus contributing to his own self-knowledge and making himself wiser. But now, consider divine thinking. If divine thinking is correct, something comes about. But if divine thinking is incorrect, then something is damaged or destroyed. So, if we possessed divine thinking, whenever we formed a false concept, we would set in train a destructive process. First in our astral body, then in our ether body, and thence also in our physical body. The consequence of a false concept, if we had effective divine thinking, if our thinking were related in some way with reality, would be to set in train something inwardly resembling a slight withering in some part of our body, a process of ossification. Therefore, we would certainly have to make as few errors as possible, for otherwise we would soon have made so many mistakes that our body would become shriveled and disintegrate completely. We would soon have worn it down completely by transposing our mistaken thinking into reality. We are in truth able to maintain ourselves within reality only because our thinking is prevented from interfering with this reality. So, as things are, we can make mistake after mistake in our thinking. And if we subsequently correct these mistakes, then we have educated ourselves and grown more wise without immediately causing havoc by our mistakes. If we fill ourselves more and more with the moral power of such a thought, the result will be that we eventually resign ourselves to no longer wanting to apply thinking at decisive points in our lives in order to gain knowledge about external matters. This sounds strange, does it not? And initially it may seem impossible to put such a thing into practice. And yet, although we cannot practice it entirely, we can at least carry it out to some extent. In the way we are as human beings, we cannot in our world completely break the habit of forming judgments about things. Indeed, we do have to form judgments, and in these lectures we shall come to see why. We have to do something for our life, for the way we live our life, which does not actually penetrate right into the depths of reality. We do have to form judgments, but through wisely educating ourselves, we should ensure that in all our judging, we practice caution in the matter of considering our judgments to be true. We should constantly endeavor to keep watch on ourselves and realize that wherever we apply our discernment, we are in fact feeling our way in the dark, so that there is always a possibility of being mistaken. This is very difficult for those cocksure individuals who imagine that they cannot make any progress at all while being expected to doubt whether any judgment they might form about anything is in fact appropriate. You only have to watch how people conduct their lives, and you will see that for many, the most important thing is to say in any situation, "I believe this, I believe that." Or when they see something, they say, "I don't approve of this, I do approve of that," and so on. If one does not wish to be one of those cocksure individuals, these are the habits one must break if one wants to approach reality in one's life of soul. The important thing, then, is to develop an attitude of mind which might be characterized thus: "Well, since I have to live my life, I also have to form judgments. I will make use of judgments in matters of life's practicalities, but not in matters of discovering the truth. In so far as I want to discern the truth, I will always keep a careful watch on myself and apply a degree of skepticism with regard to any judgment I might form." But how can we reach the truth about any kind of thought if we are not supposed to form judgments? In one sense, the answer to this question was already hinted at yesterday. We must permit the things to speak to us. We must grow ever more passive toward things and permit them to express their secrets in their own way. Much would be avoided if people refrained from judging and instead let the things express their secrets in their own way. Goethe can teach us in a wonderful way about permitting the things to express their own secrets. Whenever he wants to discover the truth about something, he forbids himself to form judgments and permits the things to tell him their secrets. Let us imagine how one person forms judgments while another permits the things themselves to express their secrets. There is an excellent example which can illustrate this. The one who makes judgments sees, let's say, a wolf and then describes it. He reckons that there are also other animals which resemble this wolf, and in this way he reaches a generalization about it. He then says to himself, "In actual fact, only individual wolves exist. I form the general concept of the wolf in my mind, but, quote, the wolf as such, close quote, does not exist. Only individual wolves exist in the world." Such a person will easily form the judgment that we are involved only with individual creatures, and that there is no reality in the generalized concept, in the idea of the wolf. A person who comes up with such ideas would be one who is quite conspicuously one of those who form judgments. Someone, however, who allows reality to speak, how will he think about the invisible aspect of the wolf, that aspect which is to be found in every wolf, and which also characterizes every wolf? Well, such a person would say something like this: "I compare a lamb with a wolf, or a number of lambs with a wolf. I shall not make any judgments, but will simply allow the facts to speak." Well, let us then suppose that a very obvious fact takes place before this person, namely, that the wolf eats the lambs. That person would then say, "What formerly skipped about in the form of lambs is now in the wolf, and has been subsumed into the wolf." It is very much worth noting that this way of looking at things demonstrates what wolf nature actually is. Following the events externally might well lead us to the judgment, if we shut the wolf away from any other food so that it eats only lambs, then surely as time goes on its metabolism will bring it about that the wolf has within it only the substance of lambs. And yet it never turns into a lamb, but remains forever a wolf. In reaching the correct judgment, we are thus shown quite clearly that the physicality of the wolf cannot be grasped by means of an unrealistic concept. If we learn from the world of external facts, it shows us that apart from the physical aspect, this wolf also has something entirely real within it which transcends the physical. It shows us that something we do not see is very much a reality. For whatever there is, which does not become submerged in the physical, is the very factor which causes the wolf to remain a wolf, even if it eats only lambs. The purely sense-perceptible aspect of the lambs has been subsumed into the wolf. It is difficult to be entirely clear about the difference between forming a judgment and allowing oneself to be taught by reality. But when we understand this properly, so that we use judgment solely for means of practical life on the one hand, and permit the things themselves to teach us about reality on the other, then we shall gradually enter into the mood which can tell us what is meant by acquiescence. Acquiescence is the condition of soul which does not wish to explore the truth on its own initiative, but instead looks forward to the truth which will emanate from things. It is the condition which can wait until the soul is mature enough to receive one revelation or another. Judgment wants to arrive at the truth at every step. Acquiescence does not work at penetrating one truth or another by force. Acquiescence of soul works to develop itself, to educate itself. It waits calmly until a level of maturity is reached where truth streams into us through the revelations given by the things, pervading us entirely. Working patiently in order to progress in wise self-education, that is the mood of acquiescence. Let us now place the fruits of this acquiescence before our souls. What do we achieve through proceeding with our thinking from amazement, reverence, and feeling oneself in wisdom-filled harmony with reality until we arrive at the soul condition of acquiescence? What we achieve is this. When we consider the plant world in all its greenery or the stars with their golden glory, when we look at all this without forming any judgment from within ourselves, but instead permit the things to reveal themselves to us, if we have reached this mood of acquiescence, then all things are transformed for us from what they were in the world of the senses into something entirely different, something for which no word exists, other than one which is taken from our very life of soul. All things reveal themselves, and especially the world of the senses, characterized here by this line, and there's a drawing. Imagine you are standing here at sea, before the world of the senses, which spreads out before you like a veil. What is characterized here in this line, A to B, represents the sounds of the sense world as they impinge on our ears, the colors and shapes which impinge on our eyes, the fragrances and tastes affecting our other organs, also with hardness and softness and so on. All this is characterized by this line. This line is the world of the senses. And it is in this world of the senses that we apply our ability to form judgments. So how do the external sciences come about? They come about because they, the sciences, make contact with the world of the senses, and because they research, by various methods, the laws and so on that are at work in this sense-perceptible world. Through the whole essence of our discussions thus far, we have seen that since judgment is not a guide, this is not the way forward into the world of reality. We can approach the world of reality solely by educating our thinking through amazement, through reverence, and so on. For then the world of the senses is transformed. It becomes something utterly new. And to make any progress in our approach to the essence of the sense-perceptible world, it is important to make contact with this new element. Let us assume that we have made good progress in developing this feeling, this soul condition of acquiescence, and are now approaching, let's say, the fresh, clear greenness of a meadow. Since there are no other plant colors in evidence, it is its fresh green which the meadow is showing us. If we have indeed progressed to a higher level of acquiescence in our soul, we shall, when observing this meadow, have a feeling somehow akin to equilibrium, but a vibrant equilibrium resembling a gently harmonious rippling gush of water. We cannot help but bring up this picture, as if by magic, before our soul. And this feeling of inner liveliness will occur whenever we experience in our soul a taste, a fragrance, or any other sensation. No color, no sound exists without expressing something. Everything gives expression to something, and everything says something, which urges us to react with a feeling of inner liveliness. Not with a judgment, but with inner liveliness. In short, we have to conclude that the entire world of the senses rises into our view as something which we can only describe as will. When we meet the world of the senses, everything is streaming, all-pervading will. Please, do take hold of this. Whoever has achieved acquiescence to a higher degree will discover all-pervading will in the world of the senses. That is why a person who has developed this acquiescence within himself, even only to a lesser degree, becomes irritated when he encounters some incongruously modish color in the street, for he cannot help but be inwardly aroused by whatever he sees around him. He is forever linked to the whole world by a will force which he feels within everything. He draws near to reality through being linked by will to everything represented in the world of sense. And in this way, the world of sense comes to resemble an ocean of will, differentiated in the most multifarious of ways. What we otherwise feel to be diffuse and scattered attains a kind of density because of this. We, as it were, peer behind the surface of things. We hear beyond the things, and we hear streaming will all around us. For those who have read Schopenhauer, I might mention that he sensed this all-pervading will, one-sidedly, in the world of sound only, and that is why he describes music as what one might call a differentiated effect of the will. In actual fact, though, everything in the world of the senses is all-pervading will for one who has attained acquiescence. Once a person has learned to perceive how will holds sway everywhere in the world of the senses, he can then also press on further. He can, as it were, move beyond the world of the senses and enter into the secrets which lie behind the sense world and are otherwise out of reach for him. In order to comprehend what is to be described next, we must first ask, by what means do we know anything at all about the world of the senses? The answer is simple: by means of our senses, by means of our ears, the world of sound, by means of our eyes, the world of colors and shapes, and so on. We know about the sense world through our sense organs. A person confronting the sense world in an everyday manner lets it work upon him and forms judgments. The person who has attained acquiescence first of all lets the sense world work upon him, but then he feels how the all-pervading will at work in the things flows out toward him, so that he floats in a communal ocean in which the will holds sway. When such a person feels himself confronted by this all-pervading will, his development then drives him onward, so to speak, as though of its own accord, to the next stage. Having first passed through the previous stages of feeling himself in harmony with the world's wisdom, of reverence and of amazement, He then learns, as these previous stages work into the finally attained stage of acquiescence, how it is possible to become united with the things, also with his ether body, which is in the background of his physical body. In the will-holding sway, the person first becomes united with the things through his sense organs, that is, through his physical body. When we see, hear, smell, and so on, the consequence of this is that, having attained acquiescence, we feel how the all-pervading will streams into us as though through our eyes and ears. We feel how we ourselves are correlated with the things. Behind the physical eye, however, there exists the ether body of the eye, EYE, and behind the physical ear there is the ether body of the ear. Our ether body permeates us entirely. And so, just as the physical body becomes united through the all-pervading will with the things of the sense world, so does our ether body also become united with them. But when the ether body becomes united with the things, we become enveloped in an entirely new way of viewing what we see. The world is then transformed in a far greater degree than is the case when we progress from the sense appearance to the all-pervading will. When we become united with the things with our ether body, these things of the world make an impression on us which renders us unable to leave them as they are, for they become changed for us when we enter into a relationship with them. Let us consider a person who has passed through the soul state of acquiescence. He looks at a green, sap-filled leaf of a plant, and then directs the attention of his soul to this leaf. He cannot leave this green, sap-filled leaf as it is, for at the very moment when he looks at it, he feels that it is growing beyond itself. He feels that this green, sap-filled leaf has within it the possibility of becoming something entirely different. When you consider the green leaf, you know that bit by bit it will grow upward and become a colored petal of a flower. The plant as a whole is actually a transformed leaf. You can learn this from Goethe's research into nature. In short, the person looking at the leaf sees that it is as yet unfinished, that it wants to progress further. He sees beyond what is evident in it. And he is so touched by the green leaf that he feels something like burgeoning life within himself. He becomes united with the green leaf and senses burgeoning life within himself. And suppose he looks at the withered bark of a tree. He cannot become united with the withered tree bark in any other way than by being overcome by a mood of death. He sees less in the withered bark than it actually represents. Someone who only contemplates the sensual illusion of the bark will marvel at it, and it will please him. He is then not seeing the shriveling aspect of the lifeless tree bark, which pierces the soul and fills it with thoughts of death. When such a uniting of the ether body with the things occurs, there is nothing in the world which does not cause either feelings of growing, of becoming and sprouting, or else feelings of decay and decomposition. It is in this way that we look into the things. Suppose, for example, that a person, having reached the stage of acquiescence in his self-development, were to turn his attention to the human larynx. The larynx appears to such a person in an extraordinary way as an organ which is at the very beginning of what it will become, because it has a great future ahead of it. One feels this immediately, because the larynx itself expresses it as its own truth. It is like a seed, and not a fruit, or something in the process of withering away. We learn from what the larynx itself tells us that something will occur in the course of human evolution. The larynx will be entirely transformed, so that whereas now it can only bring forth the word, it will one day give birth to the human being. It is the future organ of birth. Just as now the larynx brings forth the word, so will it be the seed for the organ which will in the future bring forth man, the entire human being, once he has become spiritualized. This is directly shown to us by the larynx when we permit it to tell us what it is. Other organs in the human body are revealed as having long since passed the culmination of their development. We see that they will in future not be a part of the human organism at all. Something resembling a coming into being toward the future and a dying away toward the future appears to us through this form of contemplation. Burgeoning life and decomposition, dying away, are the two things which mesh with one another when we attain this bonding of our ether body with the world of reality. This is something which will become a very arduous test for us when we have progressed a little way. Every creature we encounter will make itself felt in the way some aspects within it will give us the feeling of burgeoning and sprouting, while other aspects will generate in us the feeling of dying away. These two fundamental forces will tell us all about what we are seeing behind the veil of the sense-perceptible world. What we see in this way is termed by spiritual science the world of coming into being and dying away. So by looking into the sense-perceptible world, we have a view of coming into being and dying away, and what stands behind this is all-pervading wisdom. Behind the all-pervading will is the all-pervading wisdom. I'm using the expression all-pervading wisdom for the simple reason that normally the wisdom which people bring to bear on their concepts is not an all-pervading wisdom, but a thought-out wisdom. The wisdom we acquire by looking beyond the all-pervading will is linked with the things, and where wisdom is at work in the realm of the things, it is the all-pervading wisdom which gives true expression to its workings, the wisdom which is actually present. Where it removes itself from reality, that is where dying comes about. But where it flows in, that is where coming into being arises, a beginning, a sprouting, burgeoning of life. You see, the world which we are contemplating here, which we may characterize as the second world, can be defined so that we can say about it that first we are contemplating the world of the senses, A, and the all-pervading wisdom, B, which exists behind the sense world. It is out of this that the substance of our ether body is taken. What we see out there as the all-pervading wisdom is what we perceive in our own ether body. And what we see in our own physical body is not solely what is sense-perceptible, but also all-pervading will. Because it is all-pervading will which we see everywhere in our world of sense. This is what is so striking. When, having attained acquiescence, we meet and contemplate another person, then his bodily coloration, be it reddish or yellowish or greenish, does not merely appear to us as being reddish or yellowish or greenish. We become, in effect, as though united with the redness of his cheeks. We become united with the reality in which the all-pervading will is living. In other words, we see everything alive and at work within him, shooting across to us because of the redness of his cheeks. Those who are themselves in tune with noticing ruddy cheeks will say, a red-cheeked person is the only healthy one. You see, we approach the person himself in such a way that we are able to see the all-pervading will in him. Therefore we can say, our physical body, diagrammatically indicated here by this circle, and there's a picture, is taken from the world A, from the world of the all-pervading will, the physical body. In contrast, our ether body, which I suggest here by this second circle, is taken from the world of all-pervading wisdom, the world indicated by the letter B. This, then, is a characterization of the connection of the world of all-pervading wisdom, as it spreads out all around, with our own ether body, and the connection of the world of all-pervading will, as it spreads out all around, with our own physical body. In everyday life, we are deprived of the ability to know about a connection between the one and the other. As you can see in the way I have made this drawing, it shows that there is a direct connection between the external world of the senses and our physical body, and between the world of all-pervading wisdom and our ether body. Associations exist here. But this connection is hidden from us. We can have no influence on it. Why do we have no influence? Well, this is because there could be an occasion when our thoughts and our whole life, in the way we develop it in our soul as our life of judgment, could be, let's say, not unharmful for our own everyday reality. For everyday life, when we are awake, certain good gods have ensured that our thoughts do not have too disastrous an effect on our own reality. They have deprived us of the power our thoughts could have over our physical body and over our ether body. For if they had not done so, the world would be in a very sorry state. Let me emphasize this again. If thoughts were really to have the significance in the human world, which they do have in truth as divine thoughts, then with every error he made, a person would set in train a small process of withering within himself, and soon he would dry up entirely. And as for telling a lie, if a person were to burn up the corresponding portion of his brain with every lie, which is what would happen if he were to have any influence in the world as far as truth is concerned, he would soon see how long his brain could hold out. Those good gods have, so to speak, withdrawn from our souls any power over our ether body and our physical body. But this cannot be the case all the time. If it were permanently not possible for our soul to exercise any influence over our physical and ether body, then we would very soon have used up all the forces in our physical and ether body, and our life would be very short. As we shall see during the course of these lectures, there are forces in our soul which must flow into our physical and ether body, forces which we need in the latter. So at certain times, streams of force must flow from our soul into the ether body and the physical body. This takes place during the night while we are asleep. That is when the forces we need in order to banish tiredness flow from the universe via a detour through our capital I and our astral body. Then there is indeed this living connection of the world of will and the world of wisdom with our physical and ether body. It is into these worlds that our astral body and our I disappear while we sleep. They enter there, and that is where they create centers of attraction for the substances which must now flow from the world of wisdom into the ether body and from the world of the all-pervading will into the physical body. This has to take place during the night. If we were really to be conscious during this process, you would soon see how this inflowing would proceed. If we were to be conscious with all our errors and vices and with all the ills and so on which we commit in the world, then all this would be an extraordinary kind of trap for the forces which ought to flow in. Horrendous destructions would be visited on our ether body and our physical body through what we would send from our eye and our astral body into our physical and our ether body, out of the world of all-pervading wisdom and the world of all-pervading will. That is why those good gods made sure that we cannot be consciously present when the proper force has to flow into our physical and our ether body during the night. For this circumstance, they have suppressed our consciousness during sleep. so that we cannot cause the damage with our thoughts, which we would otherwise certainly cause. This is also what gives rise to the greatest pain when we are endeavoring to reach higher worlds on the path of knowledge, if we are making a great effort in this respect. In the description entitled How to Know Higher Worlds, you will have seen how our life during the night, our life during sleep, is used in a specific way to help us ascend from external reality to the higher realms. When we begin to illuminate our sleep consciousness with knowledge and experiences, we must indeed see how to set about properly excluding from our consciousness all sources of destruction which might affect our physical and our ether body. This is what makes it absolutely necessary to know ourselves thoroughly when endeavoring to reach the higher realms. If we really know ourselves very thoroughly, we usually stop loving ourselves. Self-love usually ceases when we begin to know ourselves. This loving of oneself, which is always present in those who have not attained self-knowledge, for it is erroneous to believe that one does not love oneself, indeed one loves oneself more than anything else in the world, this self-love must have been overcome if one is to exclude oneself, for this is what is necessary. When aiming for higher realms, we have to say, if this is what I am like, I will have to eliminate myself. We have already achieved a great deal of attaining acquiescence, but we must not love ourselves at all. We must also always be capable of feeling, I must push myself aside. If I am unable to push to one side all the things I otherwise love about myself, all those errors, all that is mean-minded, the prejudices, sympathies, antipathies, and so on, if I do not push all this to one side, then as I ascend, certain forces will become mingled with what ought to enter into me, so that I may become clairvoyant. They flow into my physical and ether body, and there are then so many errors, so many destructive processes. If I have no consciousness during sleep, if we are unable to ascend into the worlds of clairvoyance, then good gods prevent these forces from entering into the streams of the world of all-pervading will and the world of all-pervading wisdom and thence into our physical and ether bodies. But if we carry our consciousness up into the world of clairvoyance, no gods protect us any longer. For the very protection they give us consists in taking away our consciousness. So then it is up to us to remove all those prejudices, sympathies, antipathies, and so on, ourselves. All this has to be pushed to one side. For if we still harbor any kind of self-love, any kind of wishes that are personal to us, if we are still capable of reaching some judgment or other for personal reasons, then all this causes damage to our health, to our physical body, and our ether body, while we proceed to ascend further into the higher worlds. It is immensely important to keep a very firm watch on this. We must convince ourselves how significant it is that in ordinary daytime life we cannot exercise any influence over our physical and etheric bodies. Because when we are within our physical and etheric body, in ether bodies, our thoughts have nothing whatever to do with reality, and can therefore not have any decisive influence on it. During the night, however, they can indeed have a decisive influence on reality. Every false thought would destroy the physical and the ether body. We would see before us everything that has just been described. The world of the senses would appear to us as an ocean of all-pervading will, and behind this, the wisdom which builds the world would appear working through the will, whipping it hither and thither. It would show itself as the force which, with the breaking of its waves, continuously brings about the processes of coming into being and fading away, the processes of birth and death. It is the world of truth into which we look, the world of all-pervading will and the world of all-pervading wisdom. And the latter is the world of coming into being and dying away, of continuous births and continuous deaths. It is the world which is our own, and which it is immensely important to recognize. For once we have recognized it, we begin to see in it an important means of attaining ever higher and higher acquiescence, because we find ourselves interwoven within perpetual births and perpetual deaths. In whatever we do, we are in some way within the coming into being and the dying away. And something which is good becomes for us something about which we do not merely say, "This is good, this fills me with sympathy." No, we now begin to know. The good is something creative in the universe, something which everywhere signifies the world of coming into being. And about the world of evil, we feel everywhere that it is an outpouring of decay. This is an important transition to a new view of the world, one in which evil can surely be felt to be the stifling angel of death striding through the world, and in which good can surely be felt to be the creator of perpetual births of worlds both great and small. To those who comprehend such a description, spiritual science shall give an inkling of how one's view of the world can become more and more profound through the direct feeling. The world of the good and the world of evil are not merely what they appear to be in external Maya, where, with our ability to form judgments, we confront evil and good, merely in finding the one to be sympathetic and the other antipathetic. No. The world of good is the world of creativity, and evil is the stifling angel advancing across the world with his scythe. And with every evil we commit, we help the stifling angel. We take his scythe into our own hands and participate in the processes of death and decay. The concepts we glean from spiritual foundations give strength to our whole view of the world. This is what is strong, and it is what human beings must from now on take up in the future development of civilization and culture, for this is what they will need. Until now, good gods have taken care of us. But in our fifth post-Atlantean period, the time has come when our destinies, when good and evil are once more in our own hands. And that is why it is necessary for human beings to know the meaning of good in its creativity and of evil as a death-dealing principle. The end of Lecture 2.